At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Around we go, playing that game. Sell move, you's be done. They want us to stay. Around we go.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. My sidekick, Mallory.
Back
again. Another surprise guest.
Yes, another surprise guest.
And how many do I get?
We're going to give you 5 clues today.
Okay. Let's do it.
Let's see how well you know your people you've mentored, right?
Okay.
Loves fly fishing and whitewater rafting. So that should rule out some people who you know would never go whitewater rafting and fly fishing.
I think everyone goes whitewater rafting.
You have to at least once, right?
Yeah. You're not living if you don't.
You want another one?
Fly fishing.
That's a combo clue. So we'll count that as one.
Fly fishing. No.
No, not doing it for you. All right. Has gone volcano boarding more than once.
What the hell is volcano boarding?
I would assume it's like snowboarding with no snow down a volcano. The outside, obviously, of a volcano.
Okay.
Okay, no.
No.
Loves traveling to rural places much more than fancy ones. So that should rule also some people out for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, but I mean, gosh. Who doesn't, though? Rural places are pretty cool.
When you can see the actual culture and
yeah,
kind of
exactly.
What's going on in the area.
Yeah.
This is a fun fact. Has been bitten by a human.
Has been? Who hasn't?
I mean,
come on.
In a professional setting. How about that?
In a professional setting, been bitten by a human. And she's a veterinarian or he's a veterinarian?
Yeah, they're a veterinarian.
Was it a client that bit him?
I don't know the full story. You'll have to get the full story.
I'm going to have to get the full story. Yeah, I don't know that.
All right, and then your last
I didn't bite them.
No, you personally.
Okay.
And your last one is went to CSU, so that should kind of give you a clue. And they skip classes sometimes to go pack rafting.
Well, only one of my previous employees went to Colorado State.
Who would that be?
That's got to be Little T.
It is Little T.
It is Little T?
It is Little T.
Oh, my gosh. I haven't seen Little T in... ever.
Yeah, I think she came the day you retired, right? Or a couple weeks before you retired.
Gave me a hug.
Yeah. But before that, it'd probably been, close to 10 years? No.
Yeah, that's right. And she had a neck brace on.
She did.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. She, Little T, man. She, another one that I thought was going to come back and work for me.
Yeah, you'll have to get into that with her, too.
I'm going to have to get into that, too. She's absolutely incredible when it comes to... tenacity.
Absolutely.
She was very, 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 very inquisitive. Always jumped into stuff.
Always.
Never asked twice. Like, hey, I'm getting in.
No, reliable. Always showed up. Always there. Worked her butt off.
Yeah. And then she came back and, oh my gosh, I got to talk to her.
You ready? You want me to go get her?
Because I, if I'm not mistaken, her internship years were a nightmare.
They were. I thought she would be someone really good to talk to about
absolutely.
This
mentorship. Absolutely. I'd love to see her. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to see you again.
You love what I'm doing
it's just
now?
It's been 20 years.
Yeah. I know. This is what I'm doing now,
I'm
man.
I'm not at all surprised by that.
Yeah. Well, why? Well, I think I'm as much as a disruptor as you are.
Probably. Fair to say.
Yeah. So how old were you when you came? What year in high school were you?
Junior
in high school.
Or senior. Junior or senior, yeah.
And then you went to Colorado State undergrad?
No. So I started in the field when I was 15, came to you guys when I was 16. So I think probably junior year, and then Arizona, University of Arizona for undergrad.
What's with the University of Arizona grads around here? It's crazy.
It has an actual undergrad program for it. It's a really good one.
I know they do. Yeah. They have a vet school now, too.
I know they do, yeah. Yeah.
It's run by a dean that, funny story, the dean was starting his job as a clinician at the U of I.
Oh, interesting.
The last week I was in vet school.
Really?
The last week of vet school at the University of Illinois, your senior year, is 2 days.
Yeah.
And it was Tuesday. So that was on my second day. And he walked into the ICU because I had because I was in advanced surgery and I was checking on a surgical patient. And he said some smart-ass remark, right? And I said something smart-ass to him.
Figured as much, yeah.
As much, right? And he told me, by end of day, I need to go write out the Krebs cycle and put it on his desk. So I had my buddy, who is an artist, draw a bicycle.
Yeah, of course.
And label it Krebs. And I put it on his desk. The son of a bitch didn't want me to graduate. He was so pissed.
Oh, shit. That's funny.
But all the clinicians had my back. They're like, oh, that's just Gersh. Yeah. So I've always been that way.
Yes. Yes. I've always known you that way.
What is it? Obnoxious guy?
No, yeah. Yeah. Just like, I don't know. Someone said like big brother type of energy. Yeah.
Yeah. No kidding. So Colorado State, how was it?
It was great. I loved it there. As Mal mentioned, I used to skip class and go whitewater rafting occasionally. And then sometimes our car got left up there because we didn't get out before the gates closed. So we had to find a ride home. Yeah, it's interesting.
Did you hitchhike home?
Did you go
with your fiance at the time or were you?
No, Matt came with us once in a while, but he was not really as into the whitewater rafting as my best friend in vet school, Chris, was. So he'd just pull out, I mean, he actually reminded me a lot of you, but not technologically advanced in any way. He still had a flip phone, and he would bring out paper maps and be like, I see a little river on here. Let's go try to find this river and bring our little rafts. And we'd go, and rivers are not private property, but the land is, so you can't get out, but you can raft through them. So I remember we were rafting through, and there was barbed wire across because they were trying to prevent their cattle. So we're, like, ducking under while we're rafting. Just crazy shit, yeah. Wild. It was fun.
Oh, wow. And what exactly is volcano surfing?
Volcano boarding.
Boarding.
So you, I used to do volunteer work in coordinate trips to Costa Rica and Nicaragua. And so volcano boarding is where you basically sled down a volcano. So you climb up some volcanoes, especially this one, I think it was called Cerro Negro. All the big rocks fall on one side. So you climb up that side, put on a painter's suit, no helmet, of course, just some painter's suit and goggles.
Oh, it's Costa Rica. They have different rules.
There's no, you don't sign anything. If you die, they just leave you there. And you sit on a carbonated sled and your feet are the brakes if you want to use them. And they check your speed at the bottom. So if you get fast enough, then you get on the leaderboard for the month. And I definitely got on the leaderboard.
Now, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yes.
Because the one thing you always were working for me was a go-getter. Like, there was no 50% Tasha. It was 100% until you went home.
It
was pretty incredible.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, so Colorado State, you missed a couple classes.
Yeah.
Whatever.
The unimportant ones, yeah.
Graduate, and you go do an internship.
Yes.
How was that internship?
It was interesting. So the hospital was great. I loved it. It was a really good hospital, rotating internship in Marietta. But I was the last intern standing. So one left before the internship started. I don't know why. It was kind of my generation was like starting to kind of phase out of internships and go right in, trying to look a little bit more for mentorship. And then another one of my intern mates left. She had gone private practice and then did an internship, which I think would be a lot harder to go to 70 hours a week all of a sudden. So then it was down to one of my best friends, Brooke, and I, and she does not like emergency. She and I are like opposite attract type people. She did not like emergency and I did. And she was really into shelter med, and I got pregnant and I was very sick with hyperemesis gravidarum. So I would not miss, but I was like driving to work with a trash bag around my neck, like hospitalized multiple times. And I'll never forget, they pulled me into the euthanasia room to tell me, I think you need to go on leave because people can't stand to look at you. You're so sick. So I was out like in and out of leave. I mean, I was a really bad patient and I would still work, but reduced hours. And so the last intern before me quit because it was all the load was put onto her. So she quit, but I finished it.
Wow.
Yeah, it was not an easy
thing. Looking back, do you think you needed that internship?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that I got a lot of mentorship there. I think that
from specialists, right?
Yeah, I think I like being in the specialty setting, and I feel like having that access, I think it's hard to get your foot in the door if you don't. I had an opportunity to stay in Colorado that ended up fizzling out because the owner sold, and they didn't take interns, but it was one of my professors, and he was going to hire me potentially to work there and do a mentorship. But, yeah, plans changed, and he sold, so I...
Was Nicole Earhart still at Colorado State when you were there?
That sounds really familiar. What specialty?
She was a surgeon.
I don't think so then. I don't recognize that name. Yeah.
She did. She's the one who did the limb spare technique on like osteosarcoma and stuff.
Yeah.
She perfected, I don't know if you perfected it. She did the procedure, came up with the procedure and did the procedure a lot at Illinois when I was there.
Okay.
So I got to do anesthesia one time.
Nice.
I was on an Irish Wolfhound, and she was doing it. Do you know how many bottles of isoflurane I had to fill up in that machine?
Yeah.
It was 8 hours of...
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, that's a long one.
Yeah, but for each its own, right?
Yeah.
You know, osteosarcoma is not like... That's a hard call, what you want to do, right? Forget talking to the clients about it. As a clinician, you're like, chances are if I see it here, it's already microscopically everywhere else.
Yeah.
Anyways, internship, everyone left except for you.
Yes.
If you weren't pregnant and on leave, all that work would have been thrown on you?
Yeah. I mean, I think more was expected of me. I think the hard part was balancing... because it was like a pretty rigorous internship in that you got primary case responsibility, which is what I wanted. I didn't want to go somewhere and be babysat too much because I felt like it would hold me back. So you're primary on ER, but you have clinicians to bounce ideas off, much like it is even if you're not in an internship. And you got primary surgical opportunities with somebody, you know, there to scrub in if you needed help. So, I had done a lot of my ER, like they put me on ER mostly in the beginning, I think, because I had teched for them over the summer. So they knew that it would be probably an easier transition for them. So by the time I got sick, I had already done a lot of my ER and I was able to take it a little easier on the other specialties. But it definitely was harder for me to, you know, get all of the types of cases that I needed just with having to cut back my hours.
Out of your classmates from Colorado, how many are still practicing?
I think most of them. I don't know anybody else. I think a lot of us have chronic illness, so I'm definitely held back a lot by that. So I don't know anyone that's left altogether from my class, but it's definitely a growing thing.
Trend. Yeah. Yes, it's a growing trend.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and that's where my dissertation comes
in. Yeah.
So the ability to do an internship, I mean, how was your pay?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember. It had gone up that year. There was a requirement for it to go up, so it was better. If you sit down and look at the hours, you're making minimum wage when you're spending, you know,
California minimum wage or Utah, Oklahoma minimum wage?
I think it was, like, between, I honestly don't remember, maybe between 35 and 40,000. So it was better than other times, and it has continued to climb, and I think that's actually discouraged places from taking interns, to be honest.
So would you agree or disagree with this argument that you don't need an internship if you have a strong mentor?
I would agree with that. I think it depends on what you want to do. I think that the growing trend for and our professors talked a lot about that, alternative pathways that you could go. And I think if you're going GP, an internship probably doesn't make sense unless you kind of want to dabble your feet into a little bit of the other specialties and take that with you. And the mentor that you have maybe doesn't have the newest, you know, stuff in that regard. But I feel like most people that are going to GP probably shouldn't do an internship and should just find a really strong mentor. If you're going to be a specialist, I think you absolutely have to. I mean, you do have to. And I think if you're going to do ER, I still think it's useful. I think that there's definitely a difference in quality in the people that have done them for ER. Just because I think there's a little more consistency. That said, I think there are a lot of bad internships out there, and I also think there's good and bad mentors. So I think a lot of my classmates that did go on to get mentorship or internships didn't get what they
were
expecting out of it.
I agree with you that there's horrible mentorship out there.
Yeah.
I mean, mentorship is lacking immensely in our profession.
Closer? Okay.
So the now with that in mind, I have to agree with you as well that the emergency, if you're going to do emergency medicine, the best, you should do an internship.
Yeah, definitely.
Get thrown in there.
Yeah.
Because you'll start seeing everything.
Yeah.
If you're going to do general practice and just want to talk about skin conditions, flea control, ear cytologies, dentistries, it's a little different. Emergency, you have to be able to think on your feet.
Yeah.
Like, right? And the biggest thing is if you're going to do emergency medicine is you can't panic.
Yeah.
Because then your staff panics.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Okay, so you finish the internship, you have a child.
I do.
And what comes up next?
Lots of health stuff, honestly. Yeah. So I went straight into relief work, though, from a professional standpoint. So,
you did.
Yeah, I really like the opportunity to meet different people, work in different settings, travel, jump in. I like the excitement of kind of just jumping in and organized chaos. So I liked that. I think I have a personality that kind of draws to that. I think I respect support staff a lot, so it's easy for me to jump into other places. There's
so chaos fuels you.
Oh yeah. Organized. I mean, that's why emergency is
so you're a unicorn when it comes to veterinary students that are graduating now.
I feel like there's a good chunk of us that like DR, but yeah, I think it's less common. I think a lot of people hate ER. They hate the urgent stuff. I'm the opposite. If you throw me into GP, despite how you saw me before, I'll panic because I'm like, I timed appointments. Like, you know, for me, it's nice to just be kind of going with the flow and whatever's
coming in. Not
knowing
what's coming in the door.
Yeah. And I always like was really good. I think what I was good at and what I was bad at. So what I was good at was if all these chaotic cases came in, I was like, bam, 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 get them done. But then a boring thing would come in and it would just suck my efficiency down to like nothing.
Did it take your energy away, you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I have ADD, so like I'm just a squirrel brain. If something exciting comes in,
you're all over it.
Oh, yeah. But if something boring comes in, I'll forget about them.
So, how long have you been doing relief work?
Since then, since 2017. Yeah. And I do
7 years.
Yeah.
Eight.
Yeah. And I do a mix of things. I do ER. I've done a couple of urgent cares. That's a little less consistent in terms of me liking the style of medicine. I've done some shelter work, and I have done in-home euthanasia. So vaccine clinics.
In-home euthanasia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what's so crazy is at the end of my career, like, so I've been out a year.
Okay.
So starting July, August of 23, I would actually go outside and start vomiting before any euthanasia came in. I couldn't handle them anymore.
Huh. Towards the end, it switched for you.
It did. And you know what the crazy thing is? Dr. Hamill.
Yeah.
He said to me when he retired, he was like, you know what? I am just so happy I don't have to do another euthanasia.
Interesting.
And I was like, at the time, I'm like, this guy's whack.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's losing it. He's old. He needs to retire.
I love Dr. Hamill.
I get it. I know. Get it. 1,000%.
Yeah. Interesting. What do you think changed for you?
I think the emotional ass piece of it.
Yeah.
You know, the emotional labor that goes into veterinary medicine all caught up to me.
Okay. Compounding over the years.
Over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talked to my general practitioner, my internist that takes care of my health.
Sure.
And I talked to him about it. And he said, you know, you watch football, and he goes, you watch that Buffalo Bills player die on the field, right?
Yeah.
And the whole world was in, like, panic, right?
Yeah.
Like, holy cow. And he's like, do you realize that's what emergency physicians do at least 3 to 4 times a day?
Yeah. It's crazy.
And so he's like, it totally makes sense that your body cannot take that anymore. I couldn't handle the worst ones for me were the ones that were the kids left for school, empty nester, the guy, this was his dog, you know, fishing, you know, going to the coffee shop, riding the cars, going for walks around the block with his wife, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
That was the one that hit me the hardest.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting to that age, right? And
sure.
I'm like, holy cow. But I think then it was also the ones that would say, oh, this is going to be my last dog because they're like 83 years old.
That's hard, yeah.
Or when the whole family comes in and this is the dog that the kids... Like, the worst is always, like, between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're like, can you please wait till my kids come home from mm-hmm. college?
Yeah. In ER especially, we see a ton as well.
Oh.
Yep. Those are hard
ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a difficult conversation mm-hmm. to have. And the one thing I always try to tell early career vets is, like, you don't make that decision.
Yeah.
You cannot make the decision for the owner. The owner needs to make that decision.
Yeah.
But you can counsel them.
Sure. Give them, yeah. And for every family, it's different. Like, a lot of what goes into ER work as well as in-home euthanasia is just giving people the tools to make the decision that they were already going to make, but letting them feel like it's acceptable.
Yeah.
And for every family, that's different. You know, like, their threshold is different, and that's hard. But, yeah, I agree with you. Like, the ones where, like, a spouse died or a child died and this was their pet, those are mm. harder. I mean, I think for me, I'm luckier and maybe luckier in the standpoint that it might not be as, it might not stay with me as long. I'm very present and very empathetic. I'm a total empath, but I am able to compartmentalize all of those cases and not take them home with me for the most part. Obviously, there's ones that get to you, but in general practice, these are people you've known
forever.
And
generational.
So I don't know that. I don't have that thing, you know, where I'm going to see them again or things like that. But I'll never forget one who was, I think it might have even been Christmas or very close, either before or after. And I think I had 10 euthanasias in one day. And two of them were super sad. One was a service dog for a young child who was autistic. That was really hard. And the other one, their teenager had died, and this was like the kids, that was their last link to this dog, and it was like a 6-year-old golden cancer. And I walked back in the room, and they had a picture of the kid, a candle, and were like talking to her with the dog. So that one was like, that was the end of my shift. I was like, okay, I need to go home, you know. But again, for the most part, I like kind of going to in-home euthanasia, I honestly feel like that experience, I didn't get the sadness that you take home with you. I think in those, you're given so much time to be with these families. I make it like an hour-long appointment, you know? And there's just so much beauty in seeing the life for this pet and seeing them in their home environment, and families are more at peace. It's less stressful for everybody. And if you've ever been on the human side of hospice, you know how much less pretty it is. And I feel a little blessed that we are able to do that, because the differences in the end of life is drastic. So,
it is.
Yeah.
It is. But just the end of life talk, though.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, I'm curious. Did some things become harder to do when you became a parent? Not like physically and going to work and stuff, but just like aspects of work, like more of the soft skills. I found as I became a parent, things changed.
Yeah. In what way for you?
Well, I felt like the euthanasia for sure.
Sure.
You know, when you see kids crying.
Oh, yeah, that'll break you for
sure. That'll break you when you become a parent.
Yeah.
Also, as a parent, when the, you know, clients come in and they're kind of down and you're like, what's going on? They're like, oh, my daughter just got married. You know, that type
life
of those
stuff.
Just like the soft skills.
Yeah.
Like when you have that connection with your clients, you're more than just a veterinarian.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's why I like to think through my profession or my career, we tried to do, and I at least into all my mentees.
Sure.
I taught them the same, it's like, it's a whole different thing. People ask me about, at home euthanasias and those jobs, and I'm just like, you know, did I go to vet school just to do that?
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing I love about the profession is that we can do whatever we want.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is there are people who truly do not, you know, when you ask about burnout and what's like causing vets to leave, I don't feel like euthanasia is for me or for most of the people that I've in my close circle. I don't think that that's been what's taken a toll on us at this aspect of our career. And I can understand that could change as we get older. But that's what's nice about having that option is that people can, you know, refer to in-home euthanasia. But it's a whole other set of skills to be able to do that, and it's not for everybody. But I definitely
I think it's minimal that it would be able to handle that.
Yeah, I, for me, like I was planning on opening a practice. That was in my future plan, and then you know, life changed with my health stuff, and carrying big dogs became too difficult. So,
well, that's when you hire two like. NFL guys.
Yeah, help carry. I know. Yes, but I'm very particular.
Are you?
Yeah, picked up and moved and, you know, respecting all the things because you put yourself in their shoes and you think about the things that went right and wrong when it was your pet, you know? So it's, I think I'm definitely a little type A and particular on how things are handled with end-of-life care, making sure it's just as good as it can be.
Well, let's get off end-of-life care because that's a rabbit hole that it will send me off, man.
Yeah, I know.
I want to bring up my dissertation. I want to see if you agree or disagree. I think it's an absolute failure for students not to have experience before getting into vet school.
100%.
I think 100 hours is not enough.
100%.
I think that we don't have the right people in the profession.
In what way?
I think this profession, people think they're getting into it because they love dogs and cats, but then they graduate and they're like, oh shit, I gotta be a doctor.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't realize the emotional labor that goes into this profession.
True. I don't think that it's necessarily, that one I'd probably a little bit more disagree with then agree. I think that the lack of experience doesn't weed enough of those people out. But most people, in reality, have had a lot of experience just while the minimum requirement is super low. Like, I had worked for, I don't know, like,
Eight years
by the time I did it. And a lot of, I got in on my first round, which I realized was lucky, but a lot of people did not get in on their first round and they were getting experience along the way. So whether or not it was, depends on the experience, right? Some people were, you know, working in a kennel or doing things that didn't have as much direct exposure to shadow the vet. So I think there should be more guidelines there. But the people that are actually getting in, I think most of them have had a lot of experience, except for the fact that they're looking at sometimes like GPA and stuff more so than the experience.
Well, you got to my next one.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I say we're accepting students on IQ, not emotional intelligence.
Yeah, I think that is an important thing. I think for me, and I don't think, I mean, a lot of the people that I know that are veterinarians, it's not that they went in just for dogs and cats. It's like the science they are empaths, they like being able to fix things, you know. So, but what it's not, what you're not prepared for, and honestly, for me, even with all that experience as a technician, I think the biggest shift for me that made it difficult was switching to having everything, like all the liability and all of the final stuff on me.
The buck stops with you.
Yeah, and you know, lawsuits are high, board complaints are high, pets are worth a lot more money, people are very sue happy in California. Like, that was, you know, and if a technician makes a mistake, it's on me. So I try very hard not to come across that I'm ever micromanaging, but in reality, like, I'm pretty careful because it is
it's
all
an
on
art.
Me.
It's an art. Yeah. It's an art to micromanage, but don't let people know you're micromanaging.
Sure, And also from a relief standpoint, like, if I'm traveling to all these hospitals, I don't know the staff, and I respect everybody. Like, I'm, you know, I'm not going to walk in and walk over poop. I'm going to stop and I'm going to pick it up. Like, I'm not above that. It's just that I don't know everyone that I'm working with. And sometimes there's that, like, dangerous, overconfident type who's going to do something really mess it up without asking. And they're not common, but you can't always see those right away. So, you know, I'm quick to jump in and do things on my own as well.
And another thing I'm arguing is that our mentorship is weak, which we already discussed.
Yeah.
And the last thing is that not everyone's values line up with the profession.
Okay. Well, in what way for that one?
Well, it's called your professional identity, right? And you have to be able to have the same values as a lot of the other people in the profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to get into this profession, you have to realize that you are going to grind. There's no such thing as a 40-hour work week.
Sure.
And now these younger generations, some people say it's a generational thing, and it very well could be.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to look into that because I didn't want to. Some people can say it's also because the veterinary profession is feminized as well. And I didn't want to go there yet either.
Sure.
But I just think the values just, so I looked at the values, like what is expected of you as a professional?
Mm-hmm.
Are those the same values you have in your own personal life?
Yeah.
And it's a hard balance. Like, if you believe in family first,
sure.
Does that really line up with the profession if you're working 68 hours a week?
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, then you gotta go part-time, right?
Sure.
And part-time in veterinary profession is still 35 hours a week.
Yeah, and it's still okay. I mean, for me, I don't agree. I think that the shift has been that there's more focus on a work-life balance. And yes, there are more women, but I think that I don't think that that's specifically what's changing thing. The profession now versus 30 years ago, the biggest difference is what we are doing in medicine is it's so much more. Like, and everyone's come along this way. The expectations for clients are higher. The amount of work that you put in when you're actually there, it's more taxing.
And my biggest thing is the client interaction.
Yeah, and I think for me, I would say that that's the biggest focus on why, like, you know, a lot of people will say, why do we have the highest suicide rate? Why are people leaving the profession? Oh, it's women and moms. No, I don't think it's that at all. And I think it's okay if people, even if people are part-time, they're offering a ton to our profession. For me, I think the biggest thing that burns people out and increases the mental health issues is client interactions. And I think—
And what's the one thing they don't teach you in vet school? Client interaction.
Well, actually, yes. I think that there needs to be a much bigger emphasis on that. But we actually had like a whole communications thing at CSU. They had actors come in. They gave
but
you
that's
all
still,
the
yeah,
examples.
That, this yeah, that still doesn't. That it's no, it's a whole different thing. Like
totally. But I do think that I actually got more preparation for that than I was expecting, and that other schools were offering. I think there needs to be even more. Honestly, I think that should be starting in high school. I think there should be a whole freaking lifestyle skill course. How do you
don't
manage
get me started
life
in that. Don't,
and communication?
How do you budget your check? How do you balance a checkbook?
And
what does a credit card mean? Yeah, what does your credit score mean?
And teaching people emotional intelligence and stuff like that. Like, I think that is something that's lacking in our education starting in high school or younger. But as far as the client interactions, I think societally, like, we have created that one, maybe one, I don't know, what percent of clients would you say are the bad ones? 1%.
It's what?
Increased.
5% of your clients are going to make you hate your job.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes you forget about the 95% that love you.
Uh-huh. And that number is growing. I mean, I love my clients, so I'm just speaking generally. Like, I would say I get along with a very large portion, but the ones that no matter how hard you try to make them happy and, like, do the best by them, they're just still unhappy. And, you know, I understand, like, especially in emergency, and I think this is one of the things that is really interesting and definitely you need to have this in order to work in emergency is you have to have, like, you know, you can't take things too personal.
Alligator skin.
Because people are worried about their pets, man. I've been on the other end of that with my health, with my pet's health. Like, you have to just know.
Your children's health.
Yeah, you have to know how to de-escalate somebody who's just panicking and, like, taking it out and, like, not take that personal.
And they do not teach that.
No, they do not. And in some ways, you know, we get a little bit. But again, that's like, you can't teach that in one class. That should be years of people learning that. But I think societally, we've taught people that client service is number one. And I think the pendulum has swung too far. I absolutely agree we should do really, really good customer service. And having been on the human health side of things, bad service, like, it's hard to, you know, see. And, like, I know that happens on our side too. Like, we do have to be able to help families a lot and give a lot. But the customer service thing is like, oh, okay, if a client complains, even if you did nothing wrong and throws a big tantrum, they get what they want. They get a discount. You know, you're giving them top tier service. You're doing more. You're going above and beyond. You're discounting their bill. And I don't agree with that. I think for those people, I think we do have to work really hard for the ones that are good. But why are we rewarding the bad clients? It's like a child having a tantrum in a grocery store. Do you give them a lollipop or do you, like, teach them what your expectations are?
Were you at Canyon when that lady had an absolute fit because she had a three-legged cat, yet we charged her full price for a nail trim? She wanted a 25% discount.
No, that does not surprise me. Wow.
I mean,
yeah, that's the kind of stuff. And yeah. And people will, I can go on cases where it's like.
Well, I hope you learned some stuff working with Dr. Hamill and myself,
absolutely.
Like how to talk to clients.
Yeah.
Like, and that's where it goes back to the hours before.
Yeah,
and, you know,
for sure.
And I don't want anyone listening to this to be freaking out like, oh, crap, I didn't have hours before.
Yeah.
But just realize it's going to be harder to get into the game if you get into a practice that's not going to teach you that.
Yeah.
Because the hard skills, I sure as hell hoped you learned in vet school.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to learn how to use them. You're going to learn how to read lab work. You're going to learn how to read x-rays. Mm-hmm. You don't even need to read x-rays anymore. You send those off. You can put it through AI.
Yep.
You know, life is getting simpler for the hard skills.
Sure.
But the one thing that a computer or anything's going to teach, they're not going to teach you how to handle emotional clients.
Yeah. And there needs to be like continuing classes. And I, you know, this is something that definitely interests me is like how to really handle people who are upset, but aren't the ones who are just the people who go and like the ones who are just complaining because they want a discount on their bill, they need to be fired. Like if they're being rude to staff and you know, handle them, you try to explain like these are the expectations. We want to help Fluffy get them on board. And usually I can, but if you can't, like, those ones shouldn't be continued. You shouldn't be continuing to cater to them. But the ones who are really just feeling like, you know, panicked for their pet, haven't gotten, you know, the care or a mistake happened, like we need to have the soft communication skills to be able to de-escalate that. And the biggest tip, like I always give, because I teach interns as well, like part of the stuff when I've been going through my medical issues is even when I'm post-op and not able to do much, they still want me in there helping train the interns. And I talk a lot about communication. And if a client is upset, don't get defensive. Like that's going to just piss them off more. Like,
be empathetic.
Be empathetic. Because if you're saying that, like, you know, really just listen to them and like, you know, reiterate, like, I understand you're frustrated. Like that would be frustrating. And let's try to get to bottom of this. Let's work together to do this. I think that you can really help like ease those people's mind and get them back on track. And sometimes those end up being my best clients. Like they really then turn and trust me because it's like, okay, they've been through the ringer. They've had bad experiences before, but now they trust you.
It's never easy to have a crucial conversation.
No, in life. Yeah.
And especially when you're with an upset client.
Yeah.
I mean, the crucial conversation is almost an utmost importance.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have the crucial conversation, that's what gets your ass in trouble.
Totally. Yep. If you aren't communicating, like, and I think that leads to a lot of these complaints, these board complaints. It's just like not really explaining to people. Like, I spend a long time in rooms sometimes. Like, I'm definitely one to over-explain stuff if they need it because I want them to really understand, like, even before I do x-rays, it's like I want them to know that there's going to be a gray zone. I might read them and say, hey, I can't totally rule out XYZ, a foreign body, you might have to come back. If I don't tell them that ahead of time and then I say, well, I think, you know, I don't see an obvious foreign body, but here's this abnormal area, I need to retake these in 12 hours, they're going to lose it because they just spent a lot of money. So people really have to be prepared ahead of time for what you're looking for. And I explain the reasoning of each of the tests that I'm recommending, especially now with costs being high. I want people to feel like they have a say and not go back later and write a review that says I blew all my money and everything was normal and they didn't know what was wrong with my dog. Like, I tell people ahead of time, I'm probably not going to know 100% what's wrong with your dog if all this is normal.
Well, electronic word of mouth is a scary thing, especially for the newer generations because they're always on.
Yeah.
Right? They're always on TikTok, YouTube, Yelp, Google review, Facebook review, you name it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rule of thumb is one happy client will tell 10 people, one pissed off client will tell the world.
Yeah. And honestly, the emotional, like the blackmail that you see with social media, the cyberbullying, I think that's a huge, huge part of people leaving. And it's like, even if it didn't happen to you and you know it happened to somebody else, I know people who had death threats, their kids had death threats, like over stuff that they didn't do wrong. You know, a lot of it comes down to surrendering. Like, those are the big cases that turn out bad. And a case comes in and somebody can't afford it and they want to euthanize. I've been there before. They want to euthanize and the hospital offers, hey, this rescue is willing to pay the bill. They'll take the dog. You know, if you surrender it, I know it sucks. I know it's a horrible situation, but like, we want to give your dog a chance. And then you save this pet's life and then they go on and they just start the threats and the you know, lies of you stole my pet. And so most hospitals do not do that. So now the result is more pets are not getting saved.
No good deed goes unpunished.
Totally. Totally. So you get burned. And unfortunately, when that happens, then you're unwilling to do it again the next time.
Yeah. How long did it take you to learn that you're not going to make everybody happy?
I mean, I still feel like I, that's still a struggle with me, but I do feel like it's rare that I can't at least come to a point with clients that I've made them mostly happy. So, I think I'm a perfectionist in that regard. I learned it very quickly, but I still think that for me, it's those couple of cases where I'm like, I went above and beyond and they still are just unhappy and I let it go, but it definitely is still, you rerun it and you're like, man, could I have done or said anything different?
Well, so. I mean, that's the problem. Like, yeah. Rumination in our profession is there.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And then there's another one called preservative cognition.
Yeah.
Where not only are you ruminating, but the next morning you wake up worrying.
Yeah.
Like, if a spay goes wrong.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
You worry about it all night.
Oh, yeah.
And then the next day you're supposed to do a spay, and guess what you start doing?
Worrying ahead. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing straightforward about a dog spay.
No, I know. And people, the complication rate in people is crazy high.
People don't do as many spays as they do in animals.
But still, even emergency C-sections, like the complication rate's actually a lot higher.
But you started with emergency.
Yes.
Emergency C-section versus a scheduled C-section, two different things.
Yeah. Yeah, I was saying in humans. Yeah, but yes. No, I actually think I mean, the complications that I hear in people with stuff like C-sections is pretty high. So, I think for me, definitely the pressure. I think that's the one thing I wasn't expecting, because I'd had a lot of surgical experience before I graduated on my own. I did a lot of international trips that I coordinated to Costa Rica and Nicaragua. I got a lot of shelter experience. So I had a lot of spay-neuter experience, externships, obviously working with you guys, all the C-sections, just being the assistant for anesthesia. But for me, as soon as it was on my shoulders, and especially with a price tag, like, I wasn't expecting, like, when I went to emergency.
Forget the price tag, the expectations.
The expectations, because also it's like hard to find that level where you learn, but you know that when you're learning, you're not the best. And like, I'm only going to give the best to my patients. So from an ER standpoint, I mean, I was also sick and pregnant, but, I chose that internship in part because I had primary case surgical responsibility versus others. Now, a lot of specialty internships, you are lucky if you close the skin on your surgical rotation. And in school, it's less.
If you even hold a surgical instrument
in
school.
Totally.
Because now you got the senior vet student, right? But ahead of them is the surgeon.
Resident. Yeah.
And then you have the resident.
And the intern.
And then you get the surgical intern.
Yep.
Then you get the intern.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's you.
Yep.
So you're number five.
Yeah.
And that could be Friday before you graduate, and on Monday they expect you to be able to do it.
Yep. Yeah. And so for me, like, when I went into emergency and I was doing surgeries, and I had people that I could pull in and help me, but because I was the last intern standing, it was much harder, and I knew I would be slower. And so I would usually volunteer to, like, hey, I'm gonna stay on the floor, like, I know I can run the floor really quickly and you can get in and out of this surgery. I don't want to take away from patient care. So I would take one for the team a lot, because I knew I couldn't get that hands-on. And for me, if I know that it's the same cost for the experienced ER vet and for the surgeon to do the same surgery, I don't think there was like ethical dilemmas for me to go in and do them.
Your professional identity.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Your values.
Yeah. I had a hard time with that. But if I was practicing in rural Montana in a GP, I would say, hey, I have no problem doing this. It is my first time doing it, or, you know, whatever. Or you can go down the street and they're going to be more expensive. But when you're in the specialty setting, that's harder. It was harder for me. I didn't expect that.
And that's the biggest problem with corporate medicine, because they bring up that freaking term I cannot stand, which is the ACT, average client transaction.
Oh,
that's all
that
they care about.
Yeah. That's
what
why I'm
are you averaging per client?
Yeah. I've never looked at that for myself.
There's no reason to if you're reliefing.
Yeah.
So,
no, and that's one of the nice things, is that no one can tell me how to practice. You know, I don't have to ever get caught up in the management of the hospitals that have bad management. I don't get caught up in the gossip. You know, I'm there to do a good job, network with people, have a good time. I love relief. Now the pendulum has swung so far that there's so many relief doctors and people are having a hard time like keeping staff, but there's a lot of perks to it. So I understand why.
Well, I want to go into relief then.
Yeah, and I want to go into VPAs after that because you brought up surgical experience.
Okay,
yeah.
Sounds good. So let's do relief first. Yeah. Hey, around with-